Appreciate that very much. Love having special music. That's a little darker than what I thought it would be. I guess this is me using... It looks great on my screen. Well, you should be able to see the letters because the letters are all in white. But for those of you that can't see that, this is the crescent moon of the Islam religion, the Star of David for the Jewish religion, and then the Christian cross for the majority of Christianity in the world today. A lot has happened in this past week. You can't help but know what's going on if you're watching the news at all. And a couple of events happened this week that made me realize that it probably was time to go through and rehearse some of this again. Some of this may sound like a repeat of things that you've heard from years gone by, but there are enough relatively new people in the church that it would be really good for us to be able to go back and understand what is the nations of the Middle East, where do they come from, how does it fit into Bible prophecy, and let's look at some of the history that surrounds this very important region. This picture is actually what started me down this path today. This picture was a wake-up call for me. I don't know if any of you saw this or not, but what is this a picture of? This, to me, represents Europe needing to unite under a common cause. Something is happening overseas that is causing Europe to need to get together and talk. There are people in those crowds that don't even like shaking each other's hand, and yet they're there because there's a reason for them to be able to get together. We know through Bible prophecy that governments don't band together unless there's a cause, and that there's going to be a cause toward the end of the age that is going to make a united Europe possible. Now, there's two things that are missing from this picture. One is a representative from the United States, which was a shame. It should have been there, and that was a mistake. But there's something else that's missing in here, too, and that is the Pope. We know from prophecy that Europe will never be able to truly unite until it unites religiously, and that there will come a time when the good office of the Pope will be needed to try and put a united Europe together. So I think that the Pope actually was in the Philippines during the time that this happened, or he may have come, I don't know. But the fact that this picture came out made me realize, what does all of this mean? What does this mean for us? I felt it would be a good Sabbath to rehearse again the events that brought us to this point, what we can expect in the future. And so what I want to do today is I want to go through and I want to give a review of why this is happening. Why is there an ISIS? Why are there terror attacks going on? What does that mean historically? What does it mean prophetically? So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to review this. The disciples asked the question that every one of us have asked, and it is found in Matthew chapter 24. I'm going to read a couple of verses from there, so if you would like to turn there. Matthew chapter 24 in verse 3, they actually asked two separate questions, but I only have the second part of it up here. The first part of the question was, when will these things be? Meaning, when's the temple going to be torn down? When's all of this going to happen that Christ was telling them? But the second part is the question that I have up here. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, to the disciples, that was the same question. When's everything going to be thrown down? When are you going to return? Let's do this. Let's get this going. They were ready for it right then. What they didn't realize is that there actually were two questions there. The first question was, when is the temple going to be destroyed? When is Jerusalem going to be ransacked? But the second part is, when will the end of the age be? A question that we continually ask ourselves. And if you've been in the church long enough, you'll know that the church has done a lot of speculation over the years about when the end would come. One of the best scenarios that I've ever heard was a man, his name is Al Garrett, he's in the Dallas church, and he said that prophecy always reminds him like a gun. It gets cocked and it's about ready to fire, and God puts his hand over the breech and says, not yet. And mankind brings us to the edge again and cocks the gun again, and God puts his hand over the breech and says, not yet. One of these days, God's going to say, I'm not going to stop at this time. We have brought ourselves to the edge many, many times. For those of you old enough to remember back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, just how close we were to nuclear war. So when you look at what is happening, you recognize the fact that there are things for us to look at. Go down to verse 32 and 33, because I want to read this as a part of what Jesus Christ was saying here. This is the parable of the fig tree. It says, "Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and put forth leaves, you know that summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Assuredly, I say unto you, this generation will by no means pass away till all of these things take place." And that did happen. The destruction of Jerusalem was there. "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." Following what Mr. Lettier was saying, that even the prophecies that God put, it says that he didn't replace one jot or tittle of the law or the prophets. Everything is going to come to pass as he said it would. Brethren, when I look at events that were happening this week, I see figs. I see things that are starting to happen. So I thought it would be good again for us to go through this. There are three key components that have to come together for the end time to be able to happen. Three different components. We're going to talk about one of those three today. I'll mention all three of them. But if you look at what the Bible says, we know that there has to be a king of the north. There has to be a united Europe that is going to be under the control and influence of the papacy. I want to read just a couple of verses that talk about that. Just in summary, Daniel chapter 2. We'll turn to a lot of scriptures today. Daniel 2 in verse 40. Daniel 2, verses 40 through 43. Talking about the kingdoms of the world that started with Nebuchadnezzar and ended with this Roman Empire that's going to happen at the very end. It says, "The fourth kingdom will be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything." Daniel chapter 2, verse 40. "And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all others." This will be a very strong conglomeration of nations that's going to happen right at the very end. But, verse 41, "Whereas you saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom will be divided, and yet the strength of the iron will be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay." When you look at those leaders that were standing toe-to-toe, they were united for a cause, but they weren't united politically, they weren't united in any other way. They were partly of iron and partly of clay. There will come a time when this conglomeration of nations will come together. They will only come together for a while, and they will only come together for a specific cause. Verse 43, "As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay." Add to that Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17, talking about the same conglomeration of nations at the end. Revelation 17 in verse 12. It says, "The ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they will receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast." How many of those people that were in that front line marching will be a part of that? We don't know yet, because we don't know when this will all happen. But what we do know is that there will be 10 nations or 10 kings that get together and put their authority together, it says, but for 1 hour. "And they will be of one mind," verse 13, "and they will give their power and their authority to the beast. They will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is the Lord of lords and King of kings. And those with whom are called with him are called chosen and faithful." So we know that there is going to be a united Europe. There is going to be a group of 10 nations or 10 kings that will come together and will unite to be able to fight something. But what is it that's going to bring them together? What is going to cause them to want to fight? That's the second part of the prophecy. There will be a king of the south. There's going to be a confederation of Arab states under a powerful ruler. I think it's very specific. It says that there will be one king in the south, so we will see one group that will come together, and I'm going to show you some bits and pieces of what's happening right now in the news that I think bears us watching very carefully as we look and see what is happening with this king of the south. Just to reiterate this, let's turn to Daniel chapter 11, and I want to start in verse 40. So, right before this, we were reading about, in Daniel chapter 2, we were reading about the king of the north. So Something's going to happen that's going to cause the king of the north to need to get together. Daniel 11 and verse 40 is the start of it. It says, at the time of the end, the king of the south will attack him, will attack the king of the north. Something is going to happen that's going to cause this conglomeration of Arab states under a single king will start attacking people in the north, and it's going to cause the nations in the north to come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he will enter the countries, he will overwhelm them, and he will pass through. Something is going to cause north to feel like they have got to take care of this. If you look at what's happening, it seems like the United States is not getting involved. We're standing on the side. We refuse to call it Islamic terrorism. We are not doing much, but a lot of things are happening. From all the way back from September 11th, 2001, the United States has been attacked. There have been three or four more terrorist attacks that were stopped just this week within hours of happening. One in Belgium. If you read the news there, this is happening all over. There is going to come a time when the South is going to be attacking the North, and the North is going to realize we have got to band together and take care of this problem. Nobody else is going to do it for us. And it says that the king of the north will come against the king of the south and will overwhelm them. Now, if you go just a little bit further, the third part of this that's got to come together is there has to be something going on around Israel or around Jerusalem that's going to desire the king of the south to want to take it over and the king of the north to have to go and wrest it away from the king of the south. And it even says that here in the next verse. It says in verse 41 that he, the king of the north, will enter the glorious land and many countries will be overthrown. But these will escape out of his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon, that's the modern nation of Jordan. He will stretch out his hand against all of these countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape, for they will have power over the treasure, over the gold and the silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. So we know that once the king of the south starts to pick at or nick at the king of the north, this conglomeration of nations is going to get together and they are going to go down and they are going to kick some tail and they're going to get rid of this problem, this fly, this gnat in the ointment that's keep bothering them. So this, as I look today and as I saw again that picture of those world leaders that were banding arm in arm, people that normally wouldn't do that, it made me realize that this is what we see coming. Now, for the purpose of the sermon today, I don't have the time to go through all of this, so I'm going to focus today and just talk about the King of the South. I want to talk about the history. I want to talk about why there are nations that are Arab. Where did the Arab states come from? Who's the father of all of this? You hear them all the time talking about our father Abraham. And you hear them talking about the prophet Muhammad. Where does the King of the South come from? Where is this confederation of Arab states coming from in the past? And what is going to happen with them in the future? So I've got kind of two parts to this. One is the history of who the Arab peoples are from the Bible. And then the second part is the last 100 years that is bringing this chaos. Starting from 1916 with World War I until 2015, there have been three or four events that have happened that have irritated the Arab states so much that they feel like they have to fight. So I want to talk about how they got where they are, how they got into the Arab states, and then I want to talk about what has happened in the last 100 years that is causing the King of the South to have to band together. So that's what we're going to cover today as we go through this. We're going to start with Abraham. It goes all the way back to Abraham. Now, I don't have it on here, but if you remember the three symbols that I had at the beginning, the crescent moon of Islam, they claim their heritage to Abraham. The Jewish Star of David, they claim their heritage to Abraham. The Christian cross, they claim their heritage back to Abraham. All of these three religions go back to a single man. So if we go back there, then we can find out and understand where this breakdown came between these various nations and what happened. So we're going to start with Genesis chapter 16. Again, I'm going to be doing a lot of turning in the Bible and a lot of reading today. So you're going to have to keep up with me. Turn back to Genesis chapter 16 and let's read the story of Sarah and Hagar. I've got some pictures if you're into the pictures to be able to show this a little bit. Most of you will remember this story. I think that there will be some new things that you'll hear out of this, even though you perhaps have heard these stories from time immemorial. I think that if you listen closely, you're going to find some things that you didn't know about the story. I certainly did as I was going through this. I've been in the church for 45 years, and as I was researching this, I found a lot of things that I didn't know. So I would encourage you to pay close attention to this. I think you're going to see some of these things make a whole lot of sense as we understand what's going on in the world today. Genesis chapter 16, starting verse 1, says, "Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. And she had an Egyptian," that's going to be important, "she had an Egyptian handmaid or maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, 'See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid, and perhaps I shall obtain children by her.' And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai." In patriarchal times, the wife could specify that her husband could marry other women of her choice, not for his choice, but of her choice, and that if they would bear children, that child would become the child of the wife. So if Hagar would have a child, it technically would have been Sarah's child. Okay? Don't understand that. So Sarah's wanting children. She can't have them of herself, so she's saying, "Marry my handmaiden." This is not just, we hear the term concubine and think of something similar to a prostitute. It's not what this was. This was actually another wife that Abram had. So Abram does. He heeds the voice of Sarai. "Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abram to be his wife, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. And so he went into her, she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes." Something happened. Anybody who has ever had children knows that even our own daughter, I remember her saying to me after she had given birth to our granddaughter, you knew granddaughter would have to come in here somewhere in this sermon, about how precious that little girl is to her. And she says, "I love you and I love mom and I love my husband, but I've got a fixation on that little baby." That is a natural response, and you're going to see that come out in these two women. "Then Sarai said to Abram, 'My wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me.'" So the contention starts between these two wives of Abraham. And this would lead to a breakdown in the friendship between these two women. Hagar was an Egyptian and married into the Abrahamic line, which came from Mesopotamia. So the children that would come from them would be partly from the Mesopotamian line of Abraham, but partly Egyptian. That will play a factor in this as we go. Hagar now will bear Abraham his firstborn child. What's supposed to happen to firstborn children? They're supposed to get the inheritance. They are supposed to get the birthright. Sarah gives Hagar to Abraham so that she can have a child. And the theory is that the child that is born is going to be the one to inherit everything. But we see a problem here. Verse 6. "So Abram said to Sarai, 'Indeed, she's your maid.'" There were times when Abram wasn't the strong leader that what you kind of would like to be. And it was like, "You deal with this. I don't want to mess with this. 'Indeed, your maid is in your hand. Do with her as you please.' So Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her presence." Sarah was being abusive to her, probably physically as well as mentally, and in fear, Hagar now flees. Verse 7. "The angel of the Lord found Hagar by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur." On the way to Shur, that'll come in later on. Remember that town. "And he said to her, 'Hagar, Sarah's maid, why have you come down here? Where are you going? Why are you down here?'" And you'll see where down here is in a little while. "And she said, 'I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarai.' The angel of the Lord said to her, 'Return to your mistress and submit yourself to her hand.' Then the angel said to her, 'I will multiply your descendants exceedingly.'" There is a promise here that we sometimes overlook. There was a promise to this child. "I will multiply your descendants exceedingly so that they can't be counted for number." The people that were going to come from this child that was going to be born would be innumerable. "And the angel said to her, 'Behold, you are with child. You will bear a son, and you will call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He will be a wild man.'" You're going to see some pictures here in a while that will help define that. "He will be a wild man, And his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him. This race of people that would come from Ishmael would be a warring society, a wild group of fighting men. And he will dwell in the presence of his brothers. So he would stay in the land, and he would be around with other people, and they would be in constant battle with other people. And you will see that throughout the history of the people of Ishmael, that he would dwell in the proximity of Abraham's other descendants, and that would he would constantly be a thorn in the flesh to those people. All right, let's go forward now to Genesis chapter 17, and let's read a promise that was given to Abraham. Now, I want you to think about this from Abraham's perspective as we read through this. Chapter 17, verse 1, when Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am a mighty God, walk before me and be blameless." At this point in time, Ishmael would be around 13 years old. So he's a young teenager now. Verse 5. "No longer will your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations." Who's Abraham think he's talking about? "I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make nations out of you, and kings will come out of you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you and their generations from an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you." There's nothing in here about Sarah getting pregnant yet. He hasn't talked about that yet. Who does Abraham think he's talking about? Abraham thinks these promises are going to Ishmael. At this point in time, that's the only son that's been born to him. So God comes and he appears and he says, "I'm going to make your descendants to be great. I'm going to make a special covenant with your descendants." And you'll see here in just a little bit that Abraham thinks he's talking about Ishmael. Go down to verse 15. "Then God said to Abraham, 'As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and I will give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she will become a mother of nations. Kings of peoples and kings of peoples will come from her.' And Abraham fell on his face and laughed." Now, imagine this from his perspective. He's 100 years old, or will be by the time Isaac is born. What man wants a squalling baby around when he's 100 years old? I've already got a teenager. I'm having enough trouble with him. He's a wild man. I don't want a second one. Right? So he laughs. He falls on his face and laughs and says, "Shall a man be born to a man who is 100 years old and Sarah who is 90? But Abraham said to God," verse 18, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." Abraham wanted Ishmael to be the recipient of all of the promises. He didn't want a son Isaac. It didn't sound like here. Instead, he's almost like he's dickering with God. "I appreciate this, but instead of giving me a son through Sarah, I've already got a son. So let Ishmael live before you. Let him be the one that fulfills all of these promises." But verse 19, God says, "No, Sarah will bear you a son, and you will call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him." Now, the two mothers, Sarah and Hagar, already don't like each other. There's a problem already, because once Ishmael was born, Sarah didn't want anything to do with him because she wanted her own child. Now there's a promise that "I'm going to have a child," and you can see the tensions between the two are going to get even more. So God tells Abraham that Ishmael will be fruitful. He will have lots of kids. Look at verse 20. "As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him, and I will make him fruitful, and I will multiply him. He will beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you this time next year." And when he finished talking with him, God went up from Abraham. So we see now that God tells Abraham that Ishmael will be fruitful, will have lots of kids, but a covenant is going to go through another son, Isaac. What's wrong with this story? The firstborn is not going to get the birthright, and the firstborn is not going to get the inheritance. And that's the right of a firstborn. So Ishmael, probably up to this point, up to age 13, is being told, "You're going to be the inheritor of everything from your father Abraham." And he's expecting it. And Hagar is expecting it. And all of a sudden, this prophecy comes along that says someone else is going to be the inheritor. Someone else is going to get the covenant. And Hagar is not going to take kindly to this. We'll see that. So the firstborn doesn't get the promises of the covenant. And this is the first of several events that will separate these relatives, these descendants of Abraham. To this day, the Muslims believe that the promises went to Ishmael and that the Hebrew scriptures have the story wrong. I'm going to actually read something from the Quran in just a moment that talks about this, where they think that the Hebrew Bible just simply mixed up the two boys, that all those stories in our Bible that talk about Isaac were really stories about Ishmael, and vice versa, that Ishmael was the one that God actually promised it to, but because of what Sarah, how powerful Sarah was, and that the Bible was written through that lineage, that they just changed the story. So let's go on and look at the next event that happens, Genesis chapter 21. Genesis 21, and we'll start in verse 8. So the child, this is Isaac, grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. So don't know how old he would be at this time. There were some people in the patriarchal society that would breastfeed or nurse their babies up to age 3, 4, 5 years old. So this may have been a young lad by this time, or it could have been that he was only a year or two. We don't know. But assuming that he was 4 or 5, Ishmael would be 17, 18, 19 years old by this time. So he's not a young man anymore. He's in, you know what 17-year-old boys are like. And this was supposed to be a wild man. So he probably had a lot of vinegar in him that was going to come out. So we look at this, and Sarah, verse 9, saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, this would be Ishmael, whom she had born to Abraham, scoffing. He didn't want to be any part of the celebration. He was scoffing at it. Therefore, she said to Abraham, verse 10, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son. Even though he was the firstborn, Sarah was going to have nothing to do with it. Sarah knew that Abraham really liked Ishmael. And so she's pressing the flesh back to Abraham. You got to get rid of this lady. I don't even want him around, because you're going to get soft and you're going to get all mushy and you're going to try and give something to him. I want them gone. So Sarah's trying to press the point here. And the matter was very displeasing, verse 11, in Abraham's sight because of his son. He loved Ishmael. We're going to see that in the next generation too, that the father loved one and the mother loved the other. And we're going to see this continue to go. Verse 12, but God said to Abraham, don't let this be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah says to you, listen to her voice, for in Isaac your seed shall be called. I will make a great nation of the son of the bondwoman because she is your seed. So we know from this contention, it eventually boils over, and in verse 14, Abraham rose early the next morning, took bread and a skin of water, put it on Hagar's shoulder, gave it to the boy, and sent him away. And she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. This is to the south. So the contention eventually boils over to where Hagar is driven away from Abraham and Isaac, and now Hagar and Ishmael are living in a different part of the country. Sarah knows that Abraham loves Ishmael. Sarah is taking action to make sure that this heritage, this inheritance, does not pass through to Ishmael. She knows the promise from God is that Isaac is going to have the covenant. So she sends Hagar and Ishmael away. Verse 15. And the water of the skin. Yeah, so you see this picture on the right is what we're about to read now. And the water in the skin was used up, and she placed the boy under one of the shrubs. And she went and she sat down across from him at a distance, about a bow shot. For she said to herself, I don't want to see the boy die. So she sat opposite him, and she lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called out to Hagar and said, what ails you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him with your hand, for I will make of him a great nation. And when God opened her eyes, she saw a well of water, and she went and she filled the skin with water, and she gave the lad a drink. So God was with the lad, and he grew, and he dwelt in the wilderness, in this place in the south, and he became an archer. And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother took a wife for him out of the land of Egypt. So she was Egyptian. Ishmael would have been half Egyptian and half Mesopotamian from Abram. He marries an Egyptian, so his children are going to be more along the line of the Canaanites or the Egyptians that lived in the area. And he lives in the south. We'll see where in just a little while. It will actually specifically tell us where in a bit. All right, so let's learn some lessons here. What do you think might have been taught to Ishmael as he was growing up. Think of this from Hagar's perspective. We're separated from your father Abraham. As he's growing up, he's asking questions. Why did Dad kick me out? And his mom is his only source of information here. What might have been taught to Ishmael? I imagine that Ishmael would have been taught, you know, God promised to make a great nation of you. He promised you an inheritance. And that's true, he did. Several times in here, we see that there was a promise made to Ishmael. However, I can hear Hagar say this. Isaac has claimed this for himself. Sarah and Isaac pushed you out. You were supposed to get an inheritance, and you were the firstborn. But this Isaac came along, and all of a sudden we're on the outside, and we've had to scrape a living out in the wilderness. You, Ishmael, were cheated out of your rightful place in Abraham's fortune. You were kicked out of the house at age, whatever it would have been, 16, 17. And I imagine that these stories would have been passed on to Ishmael and would have been passed on to Ishmael's children, that there was always going to be this contention between the descendants of Abraham that came through Isaac and the descendants of Abraham that came through Ishmael, and that they would live in the same land. You remember the prophecies. It said, he'll be a wild man, he'll be against others, others will be against him, and he will dwell in the vicinity of his other descendants. So we know that they're all going to live together. The stories that Isaac tells were really your stories to tell, and you got cheated out of this. I want to read something to you I think is interesting. This is, again, I told you I was going to do this. This is from the Quran. This is a story that may sound very familiar. Remember the story of Abraham is told by God to go sacrifice Isaac, and he takes him up to Mount Moriah, and he's about to sacrifice him, and then God stops him, and there's a ram in the thicket. You know the story of Abraham and Isaac. Here's what the Quran says. This is the same story. Oh, my Lord, this is from Surat Uth-Safat, chapter 37. Oh, my Lord, grant me a righteous son. So we gave him the good news of a boy ready to suffer and forbear. And when the son reached the age of serious work, he said, Oh, my son, I have seen in a vision that I am to offer you in sacrifice. Now see what is your view. And the son said, Oh, my father, do as you have been commanded. You will find me that if Allah wills for me to practice patience and consistency, then I will submit to whatever is Allah's will. And he laid him prostrate on his forehead to sacrifice him. But we called out to him and said, O Abraham, you have already fulfilled the vision. Thus indeed we do reward you for doing right. And for this obvious trial we ransomed him with a momentous sacrifice. Who was that person? That person in the Quran was Ishmael. From their point of view, Abraham was to sacrifice Ishmael. From the Hebrew Bible, Abraham was to sacrifice Isaac. You see how these stories are starting to part now. They've got similar stories. They're trying to carry similar things through. And you see that today where the Jewish people will claim heritage through Abraham. The Muslim people will claim heritage through Abraham. And the only reason why the Bible says Isaac is because they tainted the story. The story really should be Ishmael, but he got kicked out. And so we go back and forth. According to them, this whole story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac would have been before Isaac was even born, when Ishmael was still a young boy. So anyway, I find that interesting as you read through this. So here, again, we have this idea that Muslims claim that this was referring to Ishmael, but that the Hebrew Bible altered the story and usurped Ishmael's inheritance. This is the first recorded incident of usurped authority, and we're going to see several more. We're going to see more in the Bible, and we're going to see more in the last 100 years. So hang on with us. Now let's go to Genesis chapter 25, and I want to read another interesting part to the story, which most of you probably don't think about or didn't realize this was even there. After Sarah dies, what happens? So Sarah is now dead. Isaac is the inheritor. Chapter 25, verse 1. Then Abraham again took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bore him Zimran, and he goes and lists all these names. And the sons of Midian were, and they list all these names. And it says that Abraham had all of these children through Keturah. Notice verse 5. Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, verse 6. But Abraham gave gifts to these sons, which Abraham had while he was still living, and he sent them eastward. So he's got more children now, theoretically from another marriage, and he's sending them eastward as well, away from Isaac, his son, into the country in the east. So we know that Hagar headed south. We know that these men headed east. So let's read a little bit more about this. I want to read something from My Jewish Heritage. These are Jewish scholars that talk about Genesis chapter 25. I found this interesting. I did not know this. Most Jewish scholars today, this is what they say of Keturah. It says, in Genesis chapter 25, following the death of his beloved Sarah, Abraham weds a second time. The Torah records it this way. Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. There is no explanation of Keturah's lineage. Some suggest that this was actually Hagar. Others say that it may have been a different woman entirely. Taking his lead from a variety of rabbinic sources, the great commentator Rashi, this is a Jewish scholar, boldly suggests that Keturah was actually Hagar and that her name was changed. So we know Abram was changed to Abraham. Sarai was changed to Sarah. According to Jewish scholars, Hagar's name was changed to Keturah, and he remarries this woman that he had spurned after Sarah dies. She was called Keturah because her deeds were as pleasing as incense. That's what the name Keturah means. It means pleasant or incense. And because from the day that she left Abraham, she did not marry or couple with any other man. So whether or not this was Hagar, we don't know. But we do know that Abraham had more children, that he wanted to separate from Isaac. And so this history records that these people from this second marriage would be the Arabic people that lived in Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, all of these people. And we're going to see that as we go through here. So we've got all of these people that are relatives of Isaac, but that are living in a different part of the land. Now let's go to Genesis 25, verse 7 through 18, and I just want to read a little bit about this. Verse 7, this is the sum of the years of Abraham's life. He lived 175 years, and he breathed his last. And his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave. And it came to pass, verse 11, after the death of Abraham, that God blessed Isaac, and Isaac dwelt in Behor Lahai Roi, this area in the north, which would become a part of Israel. Now, let's go down to verse 12. This is the genealogy of Ishmael, Abraham's sons, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maidservant, bore to Abraham. And these are the names of his sons, and they list them. I won't go through those now. Verse 16, these were the sons of Ishmael, and these were their names by their towns, by their settlements, 12 princes according to their nations. So there were 12 sons that came out of Ishmael, as the prophecy had said earlier, that you would be a father of 12 princes, and that indeed happened. Verse 17, these were the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. Now here's verse 18, here's the point. And they dwelt from Havilah as far as Shur. Remember Shur earlier, where Hagar had disappeared to. From Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt as you go toward Assyria. And he died in the presence of all of his brethren. So I'll show you a map in just a little while of where all of these people went. The descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of the other, whether they were half-brothers or full-brothers, if Abraham remarried Hagar and changed her name to Keturah, or if there were others, we will see who these people are. So let's go forward now and let's look at another story that's going to happen. Now we have the story of Esau and Jacob. Let me get back to the top here for my notes. Genesis chapter 25, now let's go down to verse 21. Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife, Rebekah, because she was barren. And the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children, too, there were twins, struggled together within her. And she said, if all is well, then why am I like this? Why are these, they're not even born yet. Why are they fighting already? Well, it was signs of things to come. The Lord said to her, I find this wording interesting. Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from you. This is completely different. I've said this before. Our two kids came out with totally different personalities. Even twins. I've known a lot of twins over the years that came out very, very different. They may look alike, but their personalities were nothing alike. So these are going to come out and be very different. One people will be stronger than the other, verse 23, and the older will serve the younger. So we see that what was going to happen here is that prophecy was going to have that two boys would be always fighting coming from Isaac. Verse 24. And so when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed there were twins in her womb, and the first came out red, and he was like a hairy garment all over. He was born with hair all over his body. So they called his name Esau. Verse 26. And after his brother came out, and as his brother came out, his brother took his hand and grabbed hold of Esau's heel. And they were fighting inside the womb, and they were fighting during the birth process. So they named the second Jacob, which means the supplanter, or the one that was always trying to get at his brother. Now, brothers don't do that. Sisters don't do that. They don't pick on each other, I know. This is probably the only family in history where the kids picked on each other. But this was pretty serious. These boys grew and grew and grew. And Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. Verse 27, the boys grew. Esau became a skillful hunter and a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. Probably from Esau's perspective, Jacob was a wimp. You know, he just stayed in the tents all the time. I'm going out and I'm hunting and I'm the mighty man of valor. So we're going to see what happens here. Verse 29, we're going to see another stealing or another usurping. Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was very weary. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with the same red stew, for I am weary." Therefore, his name was also called Edom, Esau or Edom. That'll come to play here in a little bit. So Jacob, being the good brother that he is, said, "Dude, you're hungry? Come on and have some of my soup." No, it didn't quite happen like that. He says, "If you want some soup, sell me your birthright." Well, that really was a horrible thing for Jacob to do, if you think about it. I mean, we have an affinity with Jacob because of our lineage, but that really wasn't a nice thing for him to do. You're supposed to feed and clothe your enemies, but obviously Jacob hadn't learned that yet. And Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die, so if I die, what good's a birthright to me? I'm not married with kids yet, so I might as well sell it, because if I die..." I mean, he's trying to use human logic here. Even though God supposedly has blessed me, I'm going to die here if I don't eat. So then Jacob says to him, "Swear to me this day." And so he swore to him, and he sold the birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils, and he ate, and he drank, and he arose and went his way, and thus Esau despised his birthright. Which just wasn't important to him. This wasn't something that he was going to worry about. So we see now that we have two people that are born. We see that Esau didn't care about his birthright, and that both boys were wrong. And I think if you look at this, you'll realize that both boys, Esau should have been more careful to cherish his inheritance, but Jacob should have been more loving and concerned for his brother. Chapter 26. And let's go all the way down to verse 34. This is later on in the story. When Esau was 40 years old, he took as wives Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they were a grief of mind to Isaac and Rebekah. So these ladies were not who Isaac and Rebekah wanted their son Esau to marry. In fact, we will find out later on that that caused all kinds of problems for the family. And Esau will make a change later on as a result of it. So the father is further kind of angered at the fact that he has taken local wives from the Canaanites. And we're going to see something that happens in just a while to try and right that. So let's go further. Genesis chapter 27. And you'll see this picture on the right here that depicts the second usurping. It came to pass when Isaac was old and dim so that he couldn't see, 27 verse 1, that he called Esau his son and said, "Behold, I am old and I do not know the day of my death." Drop down to verse 4. "Make me some savory food as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, and that my soul may bless you before I die." Fathers were to pass along the blessing at some point in the child's life, and until that blessing was passed on, it wasn't given to them yet. But as the elder, Esau was supposed to be the one to give it. So Rebekah, listening, verse 5, then spoke to Isaac and said, "You know, Esau is going out into the field to hunt game, but I don't want him to have it. I want you to have it. So we're going to steal it from him." And she plots this story. You've all heard this. Verse 7, "Bring me some game, make some savory food for me, that I may eat it and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death. Obey my voice and do what I command you. Go to the flock and bring me two kids of the goats, and I will make savory food for your father, which he loves. And then you will take it to the father, he will eat it, and then he'll bless you before his death." So Rebekah is trying to get this set up to where Jacob will get this. So Jacob says to his mother, "Look, Esau is a hairy man and I am smooth skinned. Perhaps my father will feel me, etc." So she says, you know, the curse will be on me. I'm not going to let this happen. And so, long story short, she prepares clothes that were Esau's. She takes some of the lamb skins and wraps them around his arm and around his neck so that he'll feel hairy. And he sends him in. And notice what happens here. Verse 18, so he went into his father and he said, "My father." He probably tried to make his voice sound like Esau's, however Esau talked. But Jacob wasn't buying it. He knew that Isaac wasn't buying it. He knew there was a problem here. And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" And Jacob said to his father, "I'm Esau." He flat out lied. There's nothing easy about this. He just flat out lied. He set up by his mother. "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done just as you've told me. Please arise, sit and eat the game that your soul may bless me." Come on, let's get this going. I sit down, let me cram the food into you, because he's probably looking out the door like this. You can see her looking out the door, and there's Esau coming up the path. So they're trying to get him to do this quickly. Isaac says, "How is it that you have found this food so quickly?" "Well, the Lord blessed me." No, the Lord didn't bless him. He just went out and grabbed a couple of kids from the flock. Isaac said, "Come near that I may feel you as to whether you are really my son Esau." So Jacob went near Isaac and he felt him. And he said, "Well, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's. And so he blessed him. And here's the blessing. Let's go down and see what it is. He came near, verse 27, and blessed him and said, "Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of the field which the Lord has blessed. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grape of grain and wine. Let peoples serve you. Let nations bow down to you. You will be master over your brothers." Oh, that's not going to settle very well, because Esau was the firstborn. "And let your sons, your mother's sons, bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." So now we see, yet again, Jacob steals this birthright from Esau. So as we go through this story in chapter 28, we now see that Esau and his time is going to be... Let me get down to my notes. I'm getting lost in my notes here. Go on to the second page. So we see again as we read through this that this was now a second time and not the last time that an inheritance is going to be usurped from them. Go to to 27 and verse 30. Let's read this first. "Now it happened as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac, that Esau came in from hunting. He had made food, he has done what he said, and he said, 'Father, rise and eat that you may bless me.' And he said, 'Who am I?' And he said, 'I am your son. I'm your firstborn. I'm Esau. Yes, I'm, what are you asking me what I'm doing here? This is what you told me to do.' And Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, 'Where is the one who hunted game and brought it into me? And I ate and I blessed him, and indeed he shall be blessed.' And when Isaac heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceeding great and bitter cry and said to him, 'Bless me also, father.' But he said," verse 35, and this is dad talking to one son about another son. Dads don't do this. "But he said to him, 'Your brother came in with deceit and has taken away your blessing.'" Oh boy, this did not make Esau a happy person. This is one angry older twin brother. "Then Isaac said to Esau, 'Indeed, I have made him,'" verse 37, "'your master, and all his brethren I have given to him as servants with grain and wine. And what shall I do now for you, my son?' And Esau said to his father, 'Don't you at least have one blessing for me?' And this is the blessing that Isaac gave to him." This is very telling. "Behold, your dwelling will be of or from the fatness of the earth, of the dew of heaven from above. By the sword you will live, you will serve your brother. But there will come a time, there will come to pass, when you will become restless and you will break his yoke from off your neck." Even though he was to be a servant to this lineage that was going to come through Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and Judah and the other sons of Israel, that there was going to come a time when he was going to say, "I'm not putting up with this anymore. I'm going to take back what is rightfully mine." And you're going to see that is exactly what is happening now. Verse 41, just to end this. So Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing which his father had blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are at hand, and then I will kill my brother." You're going to see that in spades here as we talk about what is happening right now. All right, and in... So let's just look at a couple of things here. Genesis 28 in verse 6. I will paraphrase some of this just to get through this. 28 verse 6. Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to take a wife from there because he did not want him to take a wife from the daughters of Canaan, even though Esau had done that. So what does Esau do? So Esau saw that the daughters of Canaan did not please his father Isaac. So Esau went to Ishmael and took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife, in addition to the wives that he had. And then let's see where he goes and lives. Genesis 32. Go to Genesis 32 and verse 3, and we'll end this section. Genesis 32 and verse 3. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau his brother in the land of Seir in the country of Edom. So now we're seeing where all these people went. And I'll pull a chart up here in just a moment so that you can see where all these people went. Now we start to get it. We have Ishmael, who is separated. We have other sons and daughters who are separated. And now we see that Esau is separated. And Esau marries into the line of Ishmael and starts to hear all these stories about, yeah, we know all about usurping authority. They did it to us too. So there's this camaraderie among these people and who they are, and that the people who would become the nation of Israel are the ones that caused all of this fight. So here's a map. If you can you can see this, it's not in the best focus, unfortunately. Tom or somebody, can you try and focus that a little better and see? Because there'll be some words that I'll want to read on here. So this is showing where Abraham's inheritance went. So we see Syria and Lebanon. You're going to see that'll come into play here in a bit. You see this the tip of Iraq that goes all the way down. You see Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Oman. So Egypt is over here. Remember it says that it is east of Egypt. This is the area of Shur, and the area of Havilah comes down this way. So all of this area is where Esau and Ishmael's descendants went, the Arab peoples of today. But it didn't stop there. Anyone who would look at this, thank you, anyone who would look at this worldview would say, well, if that's all there is to Esau, then the king of the north and the king of the south, it would appear that just Saudi Arabia, etc., is going to be the ones to fight. But recall that Hagar was an Egyptian, and that it also said in the prophecies that it would not only be that the king of the south would not only be Ishmael's descendants, but that they would also come from Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. So we see them actually spanning out. I found this map. I thought this was very, very interesting. Now, I wouldn't agree with everything on this, but if you can see this, this is a very telling map. This is not something that we put out, not something that a Church of God would have put out, I don't believe. But this is the origin of the nations and where they all came from, if I can get my pointer to work. And I know it's going to be very hard for you to see this, but you notice Ishmael, Esau. This is the area where the Ishmaelites and the people from Edom, Moab, Ammon, all of those became the people that will become the Arab Confederate States, the King of the South. When you look at where Israel went, because you see that there was always going to be contention between Ishmael and the other descendants of Abraham, and between Esau and the descendants of Jacob, they became the people of Ephraim, Manasseh, Naphtali, Gad, all of the people of Israel. So you see the nation of Judah and Benjamin, they stayed there. But, and I know it's hard to see this, this is Ephraim, Judah, Dan, Levi, Naphtali, Gad, they all went into northern Europe, where this conglomeration of kings is going to come from. You see Ephraim and Manasseh, and even others of Dan and Judah. There are many people from the Jewish community that live here in the United States. South Africa, you see Ephraim here, and Shem. You see people coming into the Australian continent as well as South Africa. These are all the peoples of modern-day Israel. So when you look at this, and you look through prophecy at the understanding that the Arab nations are fighting against the Israelites, it's more than just the nation of Judah. So some would ask today, well, if they're so irritated at the Jews, why are they attacking in France? Why are they attacking in the United States? Why are they attacking in Belgium? There's a reason for this. Let's go through and let's look at this here. So understand the conflict today. I want to give credit to where credit is due. James Capo, some of you may know him. He pastors in Tucson, Arizona, and Phoenix. He and I were best friends in college. If I ever tell you the story of eating chips and hot sauce and drinking beer in Manor Del Mar, this was with Mr. Capo. We used to sit down and talk about this stuff all the time. Well, he wrote this article, and I called him, and we talked about it after some of this stuff started happening in the news. He wrote an article, and I wanted to talk about this, and I want to read a little bit from his article and talk about this. If you go all the way back to 2001, most people in the United States, I think, were surprised when Osama bin Laden and others attacked the United States. Because after all, isn't this an Arab-Israeli conflict? Why are they getting at us? Why did they start bringing this to our doorstep instead of just trying to conquer Israel? Because you've heard them say that. You've heard the leader of Iran say that he wanted to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. Why are they coming over here? Is this an Arab-Israeli conflict? If you go back, some of us, I think, naively would say, well, if the Jews would just give back some of the land that they took in 1947 and 1948 when they became a state, that all this problem would go away. But the problem is much deeper than that. So I want to ask and answer the question, who is ISIS? We've heard that name, and I wanted to talk about what this actually means, and then I'll show you a picture here in just a moment. ISIS, I-S-I-S, stands for the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. So the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. That isn't a name that they use. That's a name, that's a label that got stuck here because a lot of the fighting right now is in northern Iraq and Syria. The border between the two has fallen, and a lot of the fighting is taking place up there. The Obama administration tends to use the word ISIL. You'll hear them say that, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. I'll show you a thing in just a minute on, well, actually, let me go ahead and bring it up. This is the Levant. This is the whole area of the Eastern Mediterranean. It goes all the way from... Why can't I do this? Well, this thing has decided to be problematic. So it goes all the way up into southern Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, all the way down. It includes a part of Egypt and a part of what we would now know as Jordan and the area of Saudi Arabia. So President Obama, I think, appropriately understands it is a much bigger area than just Syria and Iraq and Lebanon. So he has expanded it, and he calls it ISIL, which includes the entire area of the Levant. But they don't use that term among themselves. They call themselves simply the Islamic State. And you'll hear them talk about that. There is a video out there, and I'll show you the in just a moment. Well, actually, let me just put the picture up there. The video is called The End of Sykes-Picot. If you want to go see an interesting video, this is something that I think you might be interested in watching. And this is a man who comes from the Arabic states. These are descendants of Ishmael and Esau that are talking about the reason why they're doing all of this. Why are we attacking people? Why are we doing this? Their idea is that they need to have a single Islamic state, another caliphate, that will take over under a single king. There'll be no borders. There are no countries. There is no, right now, there is no border. All of this video is shot at the border between Iraq and Syria, where there used to be a border crossing. And the sign is on the ground, and he stomps it with his boot and says, you see how this has fallen? All of the borders will fall because all of the borders are illegitimate. They were set up by other people, not us. We want all the borders gone. There's going to be only one Islamic State, and we're going to take over. We're going to take over the world, and it's going to be slow, and it's going to be a painful process, but that's what we're all about. So this is about a 15-minute video in English talking about why the Islamic State is trying to do all of this. They are tired of the usurping of authority. We saw two examples of that. We're going to see a couple more here in the last 100 years, and it is time for them to take their nation back. That's what they feel. This king of the south is going to come together and keep pushing at the king of the north until they finally get tired and have to stop it. Now let's look at what happens in the last 100 years to where we can understand why they would put out a video called The End of Sykes-Picot. What does that even mean? Right? So we're going to go through a history of this. At the end of World War I, was the introduction of the Sykes-Picot Law. We'll read about this. The Ottoman Empire was in control of all of the Middle East, the Turks, the Turkish Ottoman Empire, and they sided with Germany during World War I. The people that were of the Arab irregulars, is what they called, they weren't really united, but they were trying to fight against the Ottoman Empire to take their land back. So the Arabs wanted their land back, but the Ottomans had it. So the British send T.E. Lawrence, you would know him as Lawrence of Arabia if you've seen the movies or read any of the books, to fight alongside the Arabs to try and get rid of the Ottoman Turks because they were siding with Germany. So Britain helps the Arabs fight against the Ottomans. So the Arabs think we've got a friend here, we've got an ally in the United States and in Britain. Now, reading from Mr. Kaplow's article. The revolt against the Turks was initiated by Sharif Hussein bin Ali. He was the emir of Mecca and Medina, and he was king of the Arabs. He saw the opportunity to liberate Arabs' lands from the Turkish rule by affiliating himself with the allied effort that were fighting against the Turks. His personal goal, His personal goal was to establish a unified Arab state. He wanted an Islamic state back in 1916 that would reach from Aleppo, which is in Syria, all the way to Aden, which is in Yemen, that whole area that's now Saudi Arabia. Working together with the British, they destabilized and defeated the Ottoman Turks. So World War I comes to an end, and he's ready to set up his Arab state. Continuing to read from Mr. Kaplow's article. Unbeknownst to him, the Allied powers had secretly devised a plot on how to carve up the Middle East after World War I. In a clandestine meeting between Britain's Sir Mark Sykes and France's Francois Picot, an agreement was drawn up May 19th of 1960 that divided the land into spheres of influence. Guess what those spheres of influence were? They were the British mandate and the French mandate. What don't you see there? There's no Arab mandate. What the Arabs were fighting with us to help destabilize the Turks was so they could have an Islamic state. They could have an Arabic league union. But Jacob usurped Ishmael yet again. We went behind their backs, and the progenitors of the nations of Israel took away what they thought they were going to do. You fight with us, and we'll make sure you've got your Islamic state. And then when it happened, then they didn't get it. There were some Arab states that were allowed to somewhat form, but they had to be under the French or they had to be under the British. And if you want to see what that looks like, it was seen as a betrayal by the Allies, that the Allies betrayed them. And so if you look at a map, then you see what they have here. This is the area. This is Sykes-Picot. So you've got direct French control. This is southern Turkey. You've got French influence. This is Syria and northern Iraq. Then you've got this area here of Iraq and Saudi Arabia that is direct British control. You've got British influence. And then we'll let the Arabs have this. Well, that's all desert. Nobody lives down there. So they basically gave them the scraps, said, we're going to take over and we're going to do the rest. And guess what? We just usurped you yet again. This is just like Jacob did, and it's just like it happened back in the days of Abraham and Ishmael. So, Sykes-Picot. So when they say that they want to get rid of Sykes-Picot, they're talking about this nonsense of the United States and Britain coming in and telling us where these artificial borders are going to be. We want those artificial borders down, and we want everything to be one nation that we can have an Islamic state, and that's what they're looking for. All right, let's go forward in time a year. We have the Balfour Declaration. This may be hard for you to read. In fact, it's so small on my screen, I'm not sure I can either. So I'll just give you a Reader's Digest version of what this is. There was a growing movement in Britain that said that the Jews should be able to move back in to this region that the Arabs thought was going to be an Arab state. They didn't want the Jews back in. They've been fighting them since the time of Ishmael and Esau. But not only are the British taking over and the French taking over, but now the British and the French are moving Jewish people back in. This is just further causing a problem. So a letter was written to the Rothschild, which were a considerable influential Jewish family, both in America and England. And it basically said, we will support the Zionist movement of moving Jewish people back into Palestine. So again, this further angers the people of the Jewish of the Islamic State. So that's the Balfour Declaration in 1917. Come forward a little bit more, and you've got the Jewish state that gets established in 1948. The League of Nations collapses, and the United Nations is formed. And in the United Nations, you've got 10 or so Arabic countries. You've got the United States, Cuba, you've got Greece, you've got India, you've got the Soviet, and you've got all these nations that have come together to form the United Nations. They decide that they are going to create the General Assembly Resolution 181. And here's what General Assembly Resolution 181 says. The resolution will give the Security Council the permission to establish a Palestinian state that allows there to be a nation of Israel. So not only were they moving people back in 1917, they now wanted there to actually be a state of Israel for them to have their own government. There were 33 people who voted for it. There were 13 people who voted against it, and there were 10 that abstained. Guess who the 13 were that voted against it? Every one of the Arab states. They didn't want anything to do with this. This was, again, usurping the authority of them having their Arabic state. You not only put us under French or under British, but now you're bringing the Jews back in, a people that we hate. So they voted against it. The resolution should have gone to the Security Council for approval, but it never did. And to this day, it just stands as a recommendation. There was never a vote in the Security Council to make this resolution binding. But because it was so popular, everybody went forward with it. Israel declared itself a state. They declared Jerusalem as their capital. And again, we have this continued irritation, and the battle wages today. We've seen several skirmishes since then. You see the Six-Day War that happened. You've seen many things that have happened where the Arabic peoples have been trying to take back over this land that they feel they were awarded by helping the Allies in World War I. And the Allies in World War I, the Allies that were supposed to be their allies in 1948 and in 1967, they keep usurping the authority that the Arab people think that they have a right. Ishmael was promised a great blessing, and it was taken away from us. Esau was promised a great blessing. It was taken away from us. And now it's continually being taken away from us by the descendants of the same people. They may not totally realize that, but I think it helps explain why they are battling with the people of modern-day Israel today, which, again, would be the United States and many people in Europe. Let's go to a couple of end-time prophecies to bring this to a close. Zechariah chapter 12. Remember, we said earlier that there would need to be a king of the north and a king of the south, but that there also needed to be Jewish people living in the area of Palestine. I want to read two prophecies about this to see what would happen at the end time. Zechariah chapter 12, and verse 1, says, "The burden of the word of the Eternal against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens and lays the foundation of the earth and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples, and they will lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut to pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it." All the nations of the earth will eventually be gathered against Israel. If you go back and you think about what it said in Daniel, the king of the south would start to push. Where are they going to push at? Well, they're doing what they can to destroy Israel. They're doing what they can to cause terror in many of the European and the U.S. nations, even in Australia. They're finding terror plots all over the place. There's one Australian boy that was pictured holding the head of this little boy had helped in an execution and severed a head, and he was holding it up proudly. This is an Australian kid that had been radicalized. So we see that in the end time, that all these nations are going to be gathered together against Jerusalem. The king of the south is going to want it, and the king of the north is going to try and stop it. Turn to Psalm 83. This is a really interesting psalm. Read through this one of these days all the way through. I'll just read bits and pieces of this. But this one is very interesting when you read about what it says. Psalm 83, I want to start in verse 2. "Behold, your enemies will make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up your head. Isn't that interesting? So many of the things that you see right now are beheadings. They have lifted up your head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people. They have consulted together against your sheltered ones. And they have said, come, let us cut them off from being a nation. How many times have you heard other, like the leader of Iran, etc., say, we want to wipe the nation of Israel off the face of the earth? This is a prophecy of what these people will be wanting to say. That the name of Israel may be remembered no more. Verse 5, they have consulted together with one consent. They have formed a confederacy against you. Now notice who this confederacy in the end time coming against Israel will be made out of. The tents of Edom. Who's that? That's Esau. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites. All these people that, these Arabs that are in the nations of Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Aden, Oman, all of those. The Moabites, the Hagarites, the Gables, the Ammonites, the Amalekites, the Philistias, that's the Palestinians. There will be a part of this, and they will join together, and they will have helped the children of Lot, Selah. So we read as we go through this, the name of Israel is to be named no more, and these listed nations are those people that came from Ishmael, from Esau, that will band together at the end with the Palestinians and many others who were from the land of Canaan. They will be the ones to unite together and be this king of the south. It's going to push against Israel and it's going to push against the king of the north. In order, if you want to ask the question and answer it, why are they attacking the United States and why are they attacking Europe? The reason why they haven't been able to conquer Israel is because of the backing of the United States and Europe. So they have to destabilize the power behind the people that are keeping Israel propped up. When you look at that map about how big the Arab state is compared to tiny little Israel, if it weren't for the power of Europe and the power of America and the power of South Africa and Australia and others who are sending troops in, there would not be anybody to stop them from taking over Israel. So they have to attack us from their perspective to try and destabilize us, just like they did against the Ottoman Turks. Slide behind. I put this up here. This is a saying. I was watching a, and some of you may have heard this, I was watching a an Arab Christian, Roman Catholic, who was had defected out of, I want to say it was Saudi Arabia, and I could be wrong, to the United States, and she was being interviewed on one of the news stations. And she said, there is a saying in the Arabic language that every school child is taught in school. Everybody knows this saying. And the saying is, first comes Saturday, then comes Sunday. And what's meant by that is, we get rid of the Jews first, because they keep Saturday, and then we're going to go after the Christians, because they keep Sunday. There is only one outcome, there's only one solution to the Islamic State, and that is for the world to be Islam. Nothing else matters to them, and they will become stronger and stronger, and at some point in time, brethren, they will put their focus behind a single leader and will start pushing against the North. First comes Saturday, then comes Sunday. The final battle is yet to be fought, but the King of the South is going to get together. They are going to push against not only the Jewish state, but they're going to push against the people who are backing them up, modern day Israel, the United States and Britain. Let's read one final scripture. Let's read Luke 21. Luke 21 in verse 20. Luke 21, verse 20. This is a prophecy again from Jesus Christ. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. And let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, to those who are nursing babies in those days, for that will be a time of great distress in the land, and wrath will be upon the people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword, and they will be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles will be fulfilled. We're going to see these people, these Gentile nations, that will continue to come against the nation of Israel. And it's going to be a very bloody time, a very bloody battle. Brethren, the figs are on the trees if we'll look at them. It's out there. Now, whether God lets the gun get fired, or he puts his hand over the breach another time, I can't say. But I thought it would be good for us to review this, because this is happening, as it were, right before our eyes. There's a lot of information that's out there. If you read behind what's being said, and you know where modern-day Israel is, you know where the nations of Esau and Ishmael went, then all of this makes much more sense. So hopefully you found that interesting, and probably will be a lot of conversation about it afterwards, which is a good thing. I thought it would be good to mention this at this time. I have a feeling that this coming week is going to be a pretty bloody one. And so as we see things in the news, just be remembering the background behind this, as I think it will make much more sense for us as we watch world news.